Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Welcome back to the second session, the second part of today's French Connection presentation. Again, my name is Daryl Bradford Smith. It is the second day of March 2006. My guest, as I told you, is James Dickey. He is a researcher, a lecturer, professor, and writer, and historian. And he spent a great deal of time on the subjects of our interest. And I got to tell you that in my private conversation with James today, it was really an eye-opener for me because, you know, rarely do I have an opportunity to speak to somebody who brings so much to the table. And, James, I welcome you to the French Connection today.
Well, let me disabuse you on one point. I am not a professor. I have never been anything more than a common or garden lecturer. Nor have I ever been a professor except for a very brief spell on the other side of the Atlantic during my brief and glorious sojourn at Harvard.
Well, you're going to be a professor tonight on the subjects we're speaking about because we need people to profess the truth on these issues, and so I'm going to give you the title professor on the show today, James, because we're going to try to profess some truth here. And one of the first things that I'd like to talk about tonight is some issues regarding the brutality and the in the implementation of Israel's first years of existence, or, well, actually, just in advance of when some of the horrendous terrorism was being perpetrated against both Britain and Palestinians, some horrors that most of the world has never really heard the full story on. And, you know, the real modern terrorism was invented by these people at this time, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. They were the first to send parcel bombs. They assassinated Count, what's his name, the Swedish representative of the United Nations in the Middle East. They placed parcel bombs in Cairo cinemas in 1948. I mean, they were the initiators of terror. The Arabs have merely taken them as their mentor. And in fact, the British were, we can say, almost as much the targets of that terror as the Arabs themselves. I mean, what about the two British sergeants who were hanged in the Olive Grove at Netanya, their bodies sexually mutilated and booby-trapped? And a photograph of that appeared, this is before the Zionist total Zionist control of the press here in this country, a photograph appeared in the Daily Express. Now, if you go to the Daily Express picture archives today and search for that photo, you will not find it. It's been abstracted, like the famous letter in the museum in America, the letter written to George Washington saying, if you allow them, meaning the Jews, into this country, they will ruin it.
Well, you know,
I refer to Benjamin Franklin. That letter is no longer in the Benjamin Franklin Museum. A historical document has been destroyed.
Well, this is not a surprising act up by these people. And one of the affairs that we've discussed on the French Connection is the Levant affair. Before we go to the Levant affair, I want to talk about how they set this system up for terrorism. They brought people in from all over Europe after the war. Many of them had quite a history of brutality to start with, and it was sanctioned at the very highest level of the Jewish community that they go out and create havoc and mayhem by enacting brutal acts. I mean, horrendous things like cutting babies out of pregnant women, and I mean they literally were out to try to scare people to death and get them out of Palestine.
Oh, yes.
by awful fear.
Yes. I mean, they massacred the entire population of one Arab village, Deir Yassin. 250 people dismembered their bodies and threw the dismembered limbs down wells. And then to give their bodies time to decompose and for the evidence to hide itself, the Haganah kept the International Red Cross from arriving at the scene for several days.
Well,
I mean, regarding Haganah, I mean, we often hear that the crimes were committed by people like Begin, you know, the Steren gang and Irgun's Vailayomi. It was the Irgun's Vailayomi who were responsible, of course, for killing the 250 inhabitants of Deir Yassin. But in fact, the Haganah were also involved. For instance, I knew the professor of Hebrew poetry in Oxford, and he told me the reason he quit Israel was that he was fighting in the ranks of the Haganah, and he said it was frightful. For instance, you know that Palestinian women have beautiful carriage, and the reason for this is because they carry the water pots in their heads. There's a kind of pad which they put in their head, and then the pot on top of that, and with their perfect equilibrium they come home from the well. Now he told me that it would see, for instance, four Arab women going to the well to fetch water. So bang, 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 and bang, four Arabs or less. It's just ghetto scum. These were the scum of the ghettos of Poland and Lithuania and Eastern Europe.
Well, now we've established their...
Well, the criminal class. You know, the same classes came to power in 1917 in Bolshevik Russia.
Well, that's right. That was going to be my next subject. But I want to go on a little further down now to the Levant affair, where they actually infiltrated Egypt, and they used terrorism in that instance in 1956, I believe the year was, in order to get America to back the actions they were taking in Sinai and some other areas. So they bombed American interests in Cairo, and then set up left behind Arab documents and very similar to what was done for 9/11, similar to what was done in many other of their their terrorist attacks.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're correct. I mean, their techniques never vary. I mean, one would wonder how they would dare to assault the property of their own ally. But didn't they do this in 67 when they attempted to sink a component of the American Sixth Fleet in the Mediterranean that was lying just offshore? And the reason for that was they wanted to cover up their crimes onshore. That ship, its name slips my mind at the moment. I'm sure you remember it.
The USS Liberty.
The Liberty. Many American servicemen, many American sailors were killed on board that ship, and they practically succeeded in sinking her. And the reason that they wanted to sink her was to destroy the evidence, because by sheer coincidence, the USS Liberty had anchored. It was monitoring, you see, the progress of the war, the progress of the Israeli army and the regress of the Egyptian. They had anchored by sheer coincidence, precisely opposite the point on land in which the Israelis were shooting POWs. So you see their adherence to the Geneva Convention, don't you?
Well, not only that, when the Americans were boarding lifeboats, they actually tried to sink the lifeboats, which is a war crime under Geneva.
Yes, but they were never persecuted, were they?
Well, one of the things that I brought up in my last conversations with Colonel Turner was that... The fact that America did nothing about it shows clearly how much control they have over the American government.
Well, that was Johnson's doing. You see, the Navy wanted to bombard Haifa in retaliation, but Johnson stopped them. I almost met Johnson's daughter, by the way. I went into the Alhambra one day. You see, I was educated in Spain, so I was living in Granada for more years than I care to remember. And I used to go up there to meet my professor of archaeology, who was simultaneously the director of the Alhambra. And when I asked for him one day, they said, oh, he's not in his office. He's showing La Hija del Presidente Johnson van the Alhambra.
Oh, no.
It was a good job I never met her.
Well, you know, so now we've made that kind of pretty clear that they've got a propensity, a capacity, and a long history of using terrorism to get what they want. But let's discuss now what they did in Russia. And we all know that Russia was not doing well as a result of Jewish financiers' actions against them before the First World War.
Yeah.
And the Tsar of Russia was losing control over his military because of embargoes that were set up by the Jewish bankers. And what they were doing is they were softening Russia for their Bolshevik Revolution. And it,
mm-hmm.
when the World War I started getting underway, the Russian troops did not want to be fighting this war. They were undersupplied. They were their equipment was antique. They were not prepared to be fighting the Weimar. And so what ended up happening was they were getting desertions, and on the back of that, they sent in how many? 4,500 with the blessings of Schief, I believe, who's from New York, came over to manage this whole thing, didn't he?
You're referring to the banking firm of Kuhn, Loeb & Co.
That's right.
And Jacob Schiff. He was only the most prominent of one of them. Let me read you a list. According to the American Counterintelligence and News Service, the following big American bankers gave money to Lenin and his comrades for the Bolshevik Revolution. Jacob Schiff, he heads the list. Guggenheim, we all know about the Guggenheim Museum.
Mm-hmm.
Max Breitung, the banking house of Kuhn, Loeb & Co., the directors of which were, at that time, Jacob Schiff. His name keeps cropping up, you know.
Yeah.
Felix Warburg, Otto Kahn, Mortimer Schiff, and S.H. Hammer. Who doesn't know about Hammer? I'm an admirer of his art collection. I even tried to see it when I was in Los Angeles. He and I have roughly the same artistic tastes.
Right, well, Armin Hammer later became an envoy. His son became an envoy during the 70s to Russia. He was bringing in American technology and giving it to the Russians so that they could keep the arms race going.
Oh, yeah. And Armin Hammer was the first person to set up a factory in Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution.
Nothing surprising there. But now as we discussed, these folks were able, with large sums of banking money and military equipment supplied in large part by America and Britain, they were able to defeat the Tsar's antiquated military machine.
Mm-hmm.
And when they installed themselves, these Bolsheviks immediately made it a crime to identify the Jews as having done this.
Yes. In fact, I read somewhere that the Protocols of Zion was punishable by death under the Bolsheviks. In fact, perhaps from the time of Kerensky onward. So I made sure, I think it was my second or third visit to the Soviet Union, I was traveling to Azerbaijan to attend a conference there, that I took with me the Protocols of Zion so that they could photocopy it and distribute it, and I came back alive.
Well, you know, here's really one of the examples, and we'll talk about other examples in a minute, but one of the examples of crypto-Judaism and crypto-Zionism rearing its head in Russia, because many of these same people changed their names. We know Trotsky was not Trotsky. We know Lenin was not Lenin.
Mm-hmm.
We have a whole list of people with very ethnically Jewish names, changing them to Russian and Slavic names so that they would be undetected by the populace when they became famous. Am I wrong?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. The Reverend Dennis Fahey, he gives a list of these names, the original name and the assumed revolutionary Slavic name alongside it in his book, The Mystical Body of Christ in the Modern World. And also he repeats the list in a pamphlet whose title I forget at the moment.
Well, you know, so what we've got here is a country that was enslaved. Now, what their payoff was, because...
Look, I can tell you this from my personal experience, the detail of the enslavement. One of my friends, when I was a student at Madrid University, was the aged professor of Russian. I think by that time he was past teaching. But Professor Sebrikov. Now, he had been destined for the church, but the revolution broke out and he had to flee. He'd gone to Mexico where he'd learned Spanish, and ultimately he ended up in Spain. And the amusing thing is, he showed me a Christmas card from the Spanish secret police. Now, not many people can say that they received that kind of Christmas card. And when I exclaimed in astonishment at the secret police having a Christmas card, he said, "Nosotros somos sus clientes." We, meaning the Tsarist exiles, are their customers. They have to protect us. It's very funny. So I asked him, was it true that 70% of the first Supreme Soviet were Jews? Think of it. In Holy Russia, 70%. Even if it had been 7%, it would be a matter for astonishment in Holy Russia. But 70%. Now, remember, he was an old man, and his hearing was going. So he said to me, what's that you said? I said, 70%. 70%. And he paused for a minute or two and then nodded his head and said, yes, I would say that was about it. Now, that comes from an eyewitness.
Now, what we do know is that this same thing is being played out in America, but we'll talk about that later in this interview as well. But now, what I want to say is they were actually supporting World War I was being perpetrated on behalf of these people at the urgings of Morgenthau, at the urgings of Unter Meyer, and we've got others. Schieff was pushing it in America. They all came, and the Germans were defeating the British roundly and soundly until America put its weight behind it, and they exacted that payment of support by getting a signature on the Balfour documents.
I'm glad you've come to me on this. I think I'm one of the few people in British academia who know exactly what took place in those years. Now, your listeners have to understand the lineup in the First World War. On one side, you had Austria, Hungary, backed by Germany and the Ottoman Empire. On the other side, you had Britain, France, and Russia, that is to say, the Triple Entente. Okay, now, the British were saying, and the British are probably the experts at propaganda in the whole world. I mean, Hitler himself acknowledges the superiority of the British propaganda machine in the First World War in Mein Kampf. Now, the British were saying, Germany is not a proper democracy. We, the British, we are fighting for liberty, the freedom of peoples, and democracy. And the Germans retaliated by saying, you bloody British, you're a shower of hypocrites, you claim to be defending democracy, and your number one ally is Russia, the Tsarist autocracy, the most autocratic state in the whole world. Well, this really worried the British, and they thought, how can we retaliate in turn? And they said, but your other ally is the Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, and Turkey persecutes her Armenian subjects, hence the Armenian massacres, expulsions, deportations, all the rest of it. So, what they did was, and this shows you how the British establishment operates. Remember, it's a tiny clique, just as there are about 8 American banking firms that control 60% of the world trade and 99% of American trade. Here, again, in Britain, it is a tiny oligarchy ruling under the semblance of democracy. Now, all these people, they all go to the same colleges in Oxbridge, they all go to the same universities, and they're all buddies. So at one point, the foreign minister, who I think was Sir Edward Grey, you remember the man famous for the phrase, lights are going out all over Europe, mm-hmm. in August 1914. Sir Edward Grey phoned up his buddy in Oxford, the Vice Chancellor of Oxford, and said, look, we are really worried about the Germans are winning the propaganda war. Now, you have to use some of your scholars to produce a report on the Armenian massacres, and that way we can discredit Germany through her ally, the Ottoman Empire. So the man said, I've got the very two people here. One was Bryce, later known as the great historian, and the other, who was he? Arnold Toynbee, whom the Arabs, in their folly, were foolish to think their ally. In fact, I was in Cairo when he came and made speeches at the Egyptian Historical Society and all the rest. None of them knew this man had published a pamphlet against the Caliphate, the central political institution of Islam, in the First World War, and I'd read that pamphlet. However, these two men spent about a year compiling a 600-page report on the Armenian massacres designed to undermine the German propaganda. Well, when it was published, everybody hoped for great things. In fact, it was a damp squib. It bombed. It went down like lead. So the British then scratched their heads and said, look, we made the wrong assessment. The Armenians are neither numerically nor financially powerful enough to pull America into the war. Now, remember, by now it was 1917. Britain was losing the war. Mm-hmm. The French army was in a state of mutiny. Britain was in retreat on all fronts, would soon have had to negotiate for peace terms. So the only hope that they had was to bring in America with its immense industrial might behind the British war effort. So they switched attention. I mean, we British, we're a pragmatic nation, you know. We don't beat around the bush. We don't waste our time flogging a dead horse. And we concluded by that time the Armenians were well and truly dead. So we issued the Balfour Declaration, knowing then that the Jews in America would use their influence within and without the White House to bring America in on Britain's side, and this is what happened.
That's
don't
right.
Let's forget that Roosevelt, I mean, with every...
Wilson.
I want to talk about Roosevelt first.
All about Teddy Roosevelt.
Roosevelt and Wilson had one thing in common. I mean, Roosevelt was not a very religious man, although he sang on the deck of the battleship Onward Christian Soldiers. It really should have been Onward Hebrew Myrmidons. But he was not a very religious man. But President Wilson was the son of a Presbyterian minister and devoutly read the Bible each morning, which had convinced him that Palestine was a Jewish country. And he had, when he arrived, you know, at Versailles in 1918, the strange delusion that Palestine was an empty country, like Antarctica. Anyway, leave that aside. These two men, outwardly so different, had one thing in common. Do you know what this was?
No.
They were both adulterers.
Yes, that's right.
Now, you may not think in libertine, libertarian America, this counts for a great deal. In fact, it counts for a great deal. Look at poor Gary Hart.
Yeah,
I mean, he got the nomination, but he didn't get any further, did he? Because of the stakeout in Georgetown with the blonde.
That's right.
You can imagine the effect that the disclosures of Wilson's adultery would have had in 1917, don't you?
Huh? Well, so what
who threatened to expose him? Colonel House.
Well, yes,
you see, you always have to ask with American power, who is the eminence grise? And the eminence grise behind Wilson was Colonel House, who was no more a colonel than I am. He was a Kentucky colonel, like Colonel Saunders. That's an honorary title in your country. And the eminence grise behind Roosevelt was Harry Dexter White.
That's right.
The communist.
That's right.
Who gave half of Europe over to the Bolsheviks.
That's right. But not only that, and what I want to add to that, too, is that at the time there was a man working behind the scenes named Brandeis, who later...
Louis Brandeis.
Oh, yes. And because of his
he was
the real...
the Council on Foreign Relations.
That's right. And, and ultimately, because of Brandeis's efforts, they put him on the Supreme Court, didn't they?
That's correct. Yeah.
So
he was one of that Zionist clique, okay, that was fixing everything toward the end of the war.
Well, So when they got the Americans into the war, what they did is the price that we were all going to have to pay was to ultimately establish a homeland for the Jewish community in Northern Europe. Now, what we got from this, we got Germany got really, really raked over the coals. I mean, this country had been led into war by a nincompoop leader, and then when they were finally going to win it, they got sold out, and then the people in that country went into a depression financially because of a boycott of their products after the First World War that sent them into a terrible depression. Am I wrong?
You're perfectly correct. In fact, do you know that British soldiers in the occupation forces in the Rhineland, they were so ashamed of their government that they were giving away their army rations to German children. And it got worse with the collapse of the mark, because by 1922, the mark had collapsed totally, and a million, no, not even 2 million marks could buy a loaf of bread, and German women were killing their children because their breasts would not lactate to feed them. And then people wonder why Hitler came to power.
Well, and that was no accident. And Hitler's Hitler had some roots in the Jewish community, and in fact, his sister, his half sister, was working at a Jewish school. In fact, and his and Adolf Hitler actually had his niece as one of his earliest lovers, And so basically what my partner and I have made the claim that they selected Hitler to be this leader because he was a misfit, because he was a mental defective, and he was a perfect man to be controlled by what they had next in mind for the Europeans.
Well, I don't think MD could read Mein Kampf and come away with the impression that that Hitler was mentally defective. I am an academic. I often ask myself, if Hitler had gone to university, would he have been able to write such a brilliant book? Now, you know, the characteristic of American prose is its freshness, isn't it? I mean, this original use of language, those insights, those aperçus, which we exhausted Britishers don't have any longer in the use of our language, which has gone stale and flat. Now, that's how Mein Kampf appears to me. A book filled with brilliant insights into the nature of and processes within history. So on this, I'm afraid we have to differ.
Well, okay, but basically though his penchant for sleeping with his niece makes him a moral defective.
You mean Gailey?
Yes.
We're never really sure, what his relationship with her was. But, the Hitler family was full of cases of incest, which is very common in Austrian rural society, you know.
Okay, well, I just find it morally bankrupt, the whole idea of that. But anyway, so we can move on now to having this whole administration of Hitler being formed. But many of his advisors, and what I've discovered from my research, is that many of his top SS men were actually Jewish.
I didn't know that, but Field Marshal Milch, who after Goering was the head of the Luftwaffe, he was half Jewish. And this makes me feel that the whole anti-Semitism of Hitler has been greatly exaggerated. The man was a pragmatist. What he wanted to do was to win wars. If the person with ability and his loyalties were to Germany, he was disposed to overlook his origins.
Well, this is my...
And we have to take into account, not all Jews are bad. I know it's a cliche, some of my best friends are Jews, but in fact, I have many Jewish friends, and I'm proud of it, too. I mean, one of my closest friends is the leading expert on Sufi music here in Britain, and together we formed a committee to bring over the whirling dervishes from Turkey. Now, he has made a great contribution to Islamic studies in this country, and is by no means a Zionist. No, what I am against is the wicked Zionist hierarchy.
Exactly right.
And I think they are imperiling the future of the Jews just as much as the future of us Gentiles.
I agree with that. And I told you that today's conversation, my dearest friend, the only visitor I had for my wedding here in France was my Jewish friend from New York, and we're dear friends to this day. And most of my friends in New York are Jewish, so I mirror
I don't want to tar them all with the same brush.
No, nor do I. No. And in fact,
I think there is a satanic hierarchy on top. And the Jews are as much victims as we are of this conspiracy.
I agree with that one. I agree with that statement as well, James. And I got to tell you something on this, on the French Connection. We try to make a distinction between criminal Jewish behavior and non-criminal. And it is no different than trying to identify a Sicilian mafia from Italian people.
Yeah.
So when we make these kinds of determinations, we do need to be careful. However, to try to defeat the propaganda that they've put out since World War II, I wanted to make the point that many of the top SS men that Hitler had working for him were Jewish. And right there, that flies in the face of him being a rabid anti-Jew, anti-Semite. And so, as you clearly pointed out, there are some anomalies about the way that history has been prepared for us. Mm. And you had a very interesting statement today about history. And I maybe if you remember what that was.
Well, actually, it's not just one, it's two. But in our brief time we had speaking together, I didn't have enough time to quote the second one. But my first quotation was from Napoleon. In my opinion, the man who gave the best definition of history was the man who made most of it, namely Napoleon Bonaparte. He said, history is a lie that is no longer disputed. And that just about says it all, doesn't it?
It does.
If you patience, I'll quote you the second one. Pope Pius XII, who in my opinion was the last real pope, because his successors, we all know the Vatican was thoroughly penetrated post-war, wasn't it? wasn't it, by Masonic and Zionist elements, and it was brought to its present level of universal discredit and contempt. Anyway, the Pope Pius XII, who was a very learned man, he had a young friend, a seminarian, who was attending one of the numerous theological seminaries in Rome. I don't know the man's name, but he must have been a young man of very good family to have been able to call on the Pope on a casual basis. And one day they were talking, and he said, you know how naive you are at that age, 20 or 21, he said that day their tutor at the seminary had said that probably only half of history was true. Now, that would have startled me too at that age. And he said, did His Holiness really think that this could be the case? And Pope Pius was silent for so long that he thought he hadn't heard the question properly, and he's about to repeat it when suddenly the Pope looked up and said, no, slightly less than half. So the question arises, did it all take place, 1066 and all that? Something took place, it may not be what the history books say it is.
Mm-hmm. And I agree with that. Now, what we've got here, I've clearly stated this before on the show. The last century, we can probably directly attribute to this Zionist group 100 million or more murders of people, both in Russia and across Europe. And when we take
look at the figures for the Second World War. It's calculated roughly in the round figure of 60 million dead.
Yes.
Now, out of these, how many received personal reparations? Only the Jews living in Israel. Why this discrimination?
Well, I don't know. That's the right question to ask. But the fact is, we also had 20 million dead in the first war. We had 30 million dead on the steppes of Russia at the hands of Stalin. And we had the Armenian murder of these folks by Jewish interests within the Sultan's Turkish government. And so what we've got here in a 100-year period, we've got the wholesale murder of over 100 million human beings.
Oh, you have to add to that another 70 million, which Mao accounted for in communist China. That was the biggest of all.
And that was at the hands of the Zionists.
I don't know the connections between Chinese communism and Zionism, but there is a connection between Russian communism and Chinese communism. And Russian communism, we know, is Zionist.
Yes. Yes. We do know that. Well, now the next thing I want to bring up here is, you know, we discussed today also a lot of the way that the media has been bought up over the last 150 years, and it almost follows a letter perfect the protocols of Zion's demand for control of the media. And could you give us a brief history of your understanding of how the media has been compromised?
Britain is said to be a country that militates against monopolies, but the reality is very different. I mean, over here we have the Murdoch press, huge press barons who are controlling everything, and Murdoch is Mordecai. Now, just about 2 or 3 months ago, I was traduced in an article in the Sunday Times, which is a quality paper. I mean, we're not talking here about the gutter press, you know, like the Daily Mail. Some of the statements they made about me were pure lies. In fact, the article was even handed to the Inverclyde police to see if there were a basis for prosecution. I had incited people to murder the Prime Minister. What I had said was, in reality, they asked me about a controversial figure in the British Islamic scene called Omar Bakri Muhammad, and I said there were two views of this man. One was that he was genuine, albeit foolish, and the other is that he's some kind of agent. And they said, why agent? And I said, well, look, at the time of the Bosnian War, he called for the death of John Major, who was at that time the British Prime Minister. And I said, do you think that if I had called for the death of the British Prime Minister, would I get off scot-free? You know what they put down in the paper? That I had called for mortar bombs to be rained down on number 10. They're liars.
Well, you know, here's the interesting thing, because the press in the United States has gone through a period of consolidation over the last 20 years, and more specifically over the last 15, that has left the entire system in the hands of only six companies. five or six companies across America, and every instance they're controlled by Jewish people, by Jewish interests.
Mm-hmm.
And it is in the extreme. That is the only hope the world has ever had for fighting back from tyranny, and we've lost it. Now,
the freedom of expression. Yeah.
Well, and the freedom of the press is just a joke.
Oh, you know what Oswald Spengler, the great German philosopher, said. He said, "What we need is not freedom of the press. We need freedom from the press."
That's right. I agree with that.
And the way the press works. In fact, there are several superimposed levels of filtration, filtering the news that gets through to us. First of all, there only are about six news agencies in the whole world. You know, the best known is Reuters, but United Press and several others.
Agency.
That is the first level of filtration.
Yeah.
The second level is the official governmental censorship, and I can give you an example of that from my own experience in a moment if you want. And the third is the voluntary censorship that the editorship of these newspapers exercise themselves. And since journalists move between visual journalism, that is to say television, or audio journalism, that is to say radio, and printed journalism, that is to say the press, I mean, really, these people are all slaves of the same system.
That's right. I agree, but what we're facing now are very few outlets and very few. Look, they've used every trick in the book to enslave our minds through propaganda, and they're the masters at this. I mean, it's more
than just enslavement through propaganda. Look, the dark and sinister forces bent on taking over this world are using the universities to accelerate the decadence. And if you read Protocol 17, there you will find laid out in detail what the Zionists are going to do to the universities. And I, as somebody who has spent half my life working in universities, I have actually witnessed these phenomena taking place in front of my eyes. One is the lowering of standards. Now, when I was a student, the 3% of the population in Britain went on to universities. True, it was an elitist concept, but these were the best of the school graduates. Now it's about 30%, and do you know how it happens? It's because the old level C is the new level A, and every year the government, which is the most mendacious organization in the country, trumpets, this year the highest level of passes, the best results ever, our schools are doing wonderful. Nothing. They're teaching rubbish.
That's right, and what we see is incompetence on a scale. But worse than that, even what's dying in America is meritocracy. I mean, what we see today is nepotism. We see everybody in at least in America. They're if you ask them what they'd like to be when they finally finish their training, and they say, I have people actually look me in the face and say, I want to be rich.
Huh?
they don't have a profession they'd like to select. They say, yes, when I get out of college, I want to be rich.
Yeah.
And I say, that's not a job. And they say, well, you know, I'll find some way to do something. I mean, none of them have a plan because basically they've not been trained in anything valuable. And you can't find a competent human being to do most of the work that needs to be done. It's a frightful condition. And yet people walk away with you know, sheepskins that have no value.
Mm-hmm.
It's astonishing to me, and yet we still do have the elite schools that are producing good students, but by and large, the rest of the system has just fallen it's shameful is what it is.
A cult of mediocrity. Yes, it's universal. And they're producing a homogenized culture, you know, in which people are incapable of thinking for themselves because they're no longer capable of formulating value judgments. And I think it's not just the universities that are culpable in this regard. I mean, there are other sinister forces that are promoting mind-evacuating things like, for instance, pop music, pornography, drugs. These are all part of the scene.
Well, you know, especially that we've done a little investigating ourselves into who's behind the child slavery, who's behind pornography,
who's behind white slavery.
White slavery.
Well,
that's
yeah,
right.
if you wanted to go to bed with a princess or a countess in Shanghai in the 1920s, it wasn't at all any problem. They were all fleeing from the Bolsheviks through Vladivostok with nothing in their wallets. So they were all picked up by the Jewish white slave dealers. Look, I tell you a very good story. You know the name of Abba Eban, don't you? Who
yes.
was the Israeli foreign minister and frequently the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations. Of course,
yeah.
Abba Eban was not his real name. It was Aubrey Evans. He was a South African Jew. There was at that time an organization called the PLA, the Palestine Liberation Army, which never succeeded in liberating even one inch of Palestine. And the head of it was a man called Ahmed Shukairi. He was a stooge of Nasser's. Now, he was in the United Nations one day. Well, Palestine didn't have a seat or even observer status as it has now at the United Nations. So he must have been part of the Egyptian delegation. And Abba Eban was on his feet giving it big licks. He was saying, those Arabs, they are backward. Do you know in the Arab countries they even have the slave trade? Whereupon Ahmed Shukairi stood up and said that if the ambassador for Israel were to persist in this line of argument, he was going to insist on permission to speak about the white slave trade. And for the first time in his life, the great Abba Eban, the great sophist of the 20th century, was speechless. He hadn't a word to say. He went as white as a sheet and sat down.
Well, you
because
know,
the white slave trade is controlled by Jews, and that's another thing they've kept from us.
Well, not only that, I mean, the Bosnian experience was a unbelievable proving ground for finding young girls and children and women for white slavery, and in fact, as many as 200,000 children have been trafficked out of that region to be prostituted in the world at large, or sold into virtual slavery and working as au pairs and housemaids around the world. The fact is that these people are involved in snuff films, pornography. It's in the West Coast of California, there is a region called San Fernando Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And that area
yeah.
is a pornographer's heaven. And it's by and large run by Jewish interest. And they're the money men behind it. And they are the producers. And it comes from this belief system that came over with the Sabaeans. Am I wrong?
With the followers of Sabbatai Zvi, you mean?
Yes, Sabbatai Zvi. I mean, where they had
century.
The wife swapping and orgies.
Oh yeah, yeah. But I think there is a Jewish Saturnalia, you know, Purim, in which the lights are put out and people copulate promiscuously. Yeah. You remember the words of Julius Streicher when he mounted the gallows at Nuremberg in 1946. The execution day was, in fact, the Feast of Purim. And he said, this is the Feast of Purim 1946. I mean, everybody in Nuremberg, down even to the hangman, Wood, was a Jew, you know.
Well, what is the Feast of Purim important for?
It's like Saturnalia in ancient Rome, you know, in which there was, for one day, universal freedom, including sexual freedom, was granted to everybody, and people just ran about the streets copulating like wild animals.
Really?
Yeah, well, there is such a rite in Judaism. It takes place in the evening, the light is put out, and then they all copulate promiscuously. Mm. It may be in order to engender something, I don't know, a demonic possession or something like that.
Well, now this date is also used in some of their invasions. They actually had some dates that parallel this Purim holiday for the attack on Iraq in one of their forays. Now, that was it happens in March. We're coming up on that date, aren't we?
Well, I didn't know about the attack on Iraq, but I have heard that the attack on the Twin Powers took place on a Jewish holiday. Some approached to Yom Kippur, and very few Jews were in the towers, whereas I think about 400 Muslims perished in that attack.
Well, you know, I got to tell you,
like the London bombings. You know that the number of Muslims who died in the London bombings was 7. I mean, that's for 53. We don't have that percentage of Muslims in Britain.
Well, the interesting thing about all of this, when we try to explain it to the mainstream Brit or American or French, We don't get much traction. Do you have suggestions after having spent so much time around young people and around universities and around the subject, how we can get further of our message from where we are today? Because I believe many people are demanding answers, and I think there is a ripening of the public for a more in-depth analysis of these events. And so my point being is that George Bush has given us all a gift, as I explained to you earlier today, of people actually despising him so much that they're looking for answers. Mm-hmm. And never before have I seen so many Americans demanding answers about what's going on in their world. This is a rare moment in our history to take advantage of, I believe. Do you have any suggestions how we can further?
Because I think historically Americans are pretty gullible, aren't they? I mean, only one third of America doesn't know that Paris is the capital of France. Well, if you put some hick out in Montana or Idaho, what do you expect? I mean, what would you know? But we couldn't even place Palestine on the map. Things are changing, and I'm pinning a lot of hope on this proposed conference in Tehran, because Ahmadinejad has been very clever. He's even sent out an invitation to that contemptible character, Tony Blair, come and debate. So they're going to invite both sides, and if we can prove that the Holocaust is a fabrication and nothing like 6 million died, possibly not even anything like a million, how many of them died of typhus, is empty. Guess, if we can prove that, then we'll find that Israel is reared on the basis of a lie, like the bloody war in Iraq, the weapons of mass destruction, another lie. See, people realize now they are being lied to. It's no longer possible like the First World War. We've got so many means of access now to information.
Well, you know, I've intentionally avoided the subject of the Holocaust and claim very little knowledge of it because where I live, you well know, is a hate crimes country. And as a result of that, I've stayed away from that subject so that I could stay in the fight.
Yes,
I'm quite certain that if I did my research in that area and started publishing what I found, I would probably be arrested. So what I've done is avoided the question altogether and tried to go on to other subjects that won't have me put in shackles.
Mm-hmm.
And that, so on the French Connection, I don't take a stand on it because I don't know the facts. I really don't. I do know this. A lot of good Jews and Gypsies and many others were needlessly killed. Many of them worked to death, and many of them starved as a result of terrible events that spun around their lives, resulting from war. And mm-hmm. So the truth is there was terrible suffering in that period of history, and how all of those facts lay out, I cannot divine at this moment, but I do know.
Frightful. And if only 600,000 Jews died in concentration camps, that is unquestionably a crime against humanity. But then what about the saturation bombing of German cities with 2 million civilians killed? You know that in one city alone, Hamburg, more people died in one night than died in Britain during all the 6 years of the war.
Yeah.
These are the things we are never told. I mean, the other day, when I was at the Irving trial in Vienna, I was approached by this girl from Der Spiegel, and she said, I'd like to interview you, Dr. Dickey. And I said, look, I never give interviews to people from Der Spiegel, even when they're such pretty girls as you. And she said, why? I said, because it's all lies. And I told her this, and I said, did you know, because Der Spiegel is published in Hamburg, that more people died in your city in one night than died in Britain during 6 years of the war? No, she said, well, we haven't told that in school. No, I said, you won't be, because Germany is ruled under occupation law.
Well, not only is it ruled under occupation law, the present prime minister of that country is a frightful Zionist who is forwarding...
Angela Merkel. There's nothing worse than a woman in politics. I always remember what Hitler said about Eva Braun. The good thing about Eva is that she is no political woman. If my wife were to vote in a general election, I tell you I would divorce her. She's laughing at the woman, but I assure you, I assure her too, that I am deadly serious.
I'm a modern guy.
Mrs. Bandaranaike, Mrs. Gandhi, and worst of all, Mrs. T. Well, I should tell you about Mrs. T. Come on, let's have a little talk about Mrs. T.
Okay, the Iron Lady, right?
The Iron Lady. I want to tell you something about her ferrous exterior. Well, we've all heard of the Bilderbergers, haven't we?
They meet at a different
place all over the year, determining the fates of ordinary little people like you and me. Okay? Well, this year the meeting was somewhere the year I'm referring to. Which wasn't exactly yesterday. We're talking, I think, about 30 years ago. Well, the meeting was somewhere in Holland. And you know those meetings are held under conditions of total secrecy. When the Bilderbergers held their annual meeting at Harrogate in Yorkshire, do you know that all the staff, from the cook down to the merest shoeshine boy, was moved out, and their own people, security services, were moved in, even to black your boots. At any rate, at that meeting was present Kissinger. Now, if anyone were to ask me today if I could name a living member who is one of the learned elders of Zion, I would say, beyond any shadow of a doubt, Henry Kissinger.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, the Kiss was there, and Dennis Healey, that famous ex-com, was there, and do not think that communism is any impediment to becoming a cabinet minister here in our country. We've got one just now, John Reed, who was the hero of the Upper Clyde shipbuilders trying to rescue the men's jobs, a rabid communist back in the 70s when shipbuilding here on the Clyde collapsed, and now he is one of the most fervent supporters of the war against Iraq. He is, in fact, Minister of War, which they now call Ministry of Defense. That's part of the Orwellian newspeak that people use today, you see?
Mm-hmm.
So, at any rate, Healey had brought along a certain lady called Mrs. Thatcher. Now, after 2 days, Kissinger went up to Healey and he said, look, why did you bring that woman here? So far, she hasn't opened her mouth. So Healey had a word in her ear, and the following morning, she gave them a half-hour speech that floored them all, and there and then it was decided that she would be the next Prime Minister of Britain.
Well, you know, dismantling protections of Britain in the 70s was her specialty, and George Bush is playing that very same role today in dismantling all the protections that Americans have enjoyed over the generations. And now, in both instances, what we've got left behind after the fact is tyranny.
We've lost the provisions of Magna Carta. Well, I'm Scots, so Magna Carta doesn't apply here, but it's applied to all Englishmen. It's the basis of English liberty since 1212.
We've gone
back beyond the Middle Ages. We are now advancing toward the Dark Ages.
That's right.
Courtesy of Tony Blair.
Yes, well, you know, the United States Constitution has been killed by these...
Yeah. I don't think it's only in Germany there are concentration camps, although it was the British, of course, who invented the concentration camp format.
Yeah, with the Boers, right? With the Boer War.
Here they are called detention camps. And we've got, I can name several of them, with people in them at this moment who are being held without trial, and they have really nothing against them except suspicion and the attempt to create a climate of fear amongst the Muslims in Britain.
Well, you know something, I gotta ask you a favor. I know that you've got a lot of other things to do in the next weeks. I hope you can find some time to come back to the French Connection, and I will give you maybe a subject that we can discuss in further detail, something
mm-hmm.
more specific. I'll give you, you know, days to maybe, or even a week if you'd like, to take a look at some of the information, and we can do like a university type of discussion mm-hmm. on a couple mm-hmm. of topics.
Yeah, a seminar, an in-depth analysis. You'll be my student. I'll be the professor. Hmm?
You are the professor, James. And I got to tell you, you know, this job, as much as I loathe having to go through this for our world, I got to tell you that there is a certain satisfaction that comes in standing side by side with brave people who have.
Well,
you
are a warrior in defense of the truth. That is the most important thing of all.
Yeah.
And God's promise in the Quran is, and I quote the Arabic, "In al batil kana zahukan," the error is destined always to perish.
Well, you know, if they are successful in putting in the controlled mechanisms that we have available to us today, these electronic situations where tracking becomes a matter of a computer, not a human being running behind you,
mm-hmm.
I fear we may not be able to unshackle ourselves. So it's really contingent upon our efforts today to defeat them in advance of these systems being placed upon us. And this means that every single person listening to these broadcasts needs to truly become a part of the fight. And that means to enlist as many human beings to these facts as we can muster. Because, look, unless we are able
to... An army of truth.
And it's going to take each individual who's hearing this, James, to bring one more person to this a week. Just one person per week.
If only one person is listening to what I'm saying tonight and takes and goes not to the works of the British court historians, who are professional liars, because that's how they get their Oxbridge chairs and their knighthoods and their seats in the House of Lords, but goes to the primary sources, archival material, and searches there. And this material exists. It just takes effort to find it out. And that's the trouble. We're all lazy today.
Well, I'm not, and you're not, and neither is Eric Hofschmidt and many others, and my listeners are not. They have proven to me willing to go out and try to find the people to bring to these broadcasts. I want to thank you for coming on today. We could continue, but, you know, there comes a point where this turns out to be a show, and this is that point. And so I want to thank you, truly thank you, James, for giving this this honest effort and this honest presentation today. As I told you in advance, it was going to meander to a lot of subjects, and it has done that.
Well, rely on me anytime. Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks, James, and I will be in touch with you, sir, very soon.
Okay, then. Bye.
Thank you.
Good night.
Bye-bye now. That was Dr. James Dickey. And ladies and gentlemen, in order to really fully appreciate this man's efforts and this man's capacities, one needs to go out now and do as much of the verifying of the things that we discussed today as possible. I'm going to bring him back on a more succinct subject in a future date, but I wanted to introduce him to you in a general sense, and so that you would have an understanding of just how well-versed in these facts this man is. And I believe we actually broached several new subjects and added some weight to others. So the French Connection is dedicated to bringing forward these facts. You know, you go to our website, and a lot of people think we're all about innuendo and we're about trashing people and everything else. No, we're not. I deny that, and I repudiate that stance about the French Connection. We are about the facts. We are about bringing forward the evidence, and we are about being suspicious of people who should be held in a suspicious sense. Because you know what? We have no time to be defeated by people in our midst who are working against us. We have to fight back against that. But that being said, the next show, tomorrow, we'll have another guest. I'm not sure who it'll be. But, you know, it's harder and harder to get quality people to come on. I hope you've enjoyed my guest today. His name is Dr. James Dickey. And until the next time we meet, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for tuning in to The French Connection.